My name is Brian Bonsenauer, and I'm teaching now at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire these days. And someone asked me to identify this t-shirt, Gonzaga University. This is where I grew up in Spokane, Washington, the university there. Also called Godzilla or many other euphemisms of endearment. But
this is like coming home.
Right. Eastern Washington and the North Cascades is very much, I consider my home, one of the places that I love to be. So I'm really glad to be here. And glad that you're all here for this session today called The Fundamental Ordering of the Universe. And the subtitle was Tracing the Weave of the Universe. And so to get started with that, I sort of borrow this from the Ark out there, which if you haven't seen it out there is a weaving, a community weaving that's going on, been going on for a couple weeks now, of many different people involved in forming this weave. And I like the image of a weave, the analogy of the weave for what we'll be talking about today, for many reasons. The one that's that I think is most useful for this topic is these three things, characteristics that we'll talk about today. You can kind of think of them as this warp on the loom. They're what supports, what underlies, what makes possible the rest of the weaving. And at different points in the weaving, that warp kind of shows through. You can see the warp kind of peeking through in different parts of this weaving. Other parts, it's a little more muted, but it's still there just by the very nature of that weaving exists there. So, the fundamental weave of the universe is another way of thinking about what we'll be talking about today. Let's put this up here so you can keep in mind the beautiful diversity going on in this weaving. And you're welcome later on to go ahead and participate in that weaving. It's lots of fun. I thought I'd start, as I've started most of the sessions, with a story. And this story comes out of work by Brian Swim and Thomas Berry in a book called The Universe Story. The Universe Story is some work, among others, that's starting a process of re-imaging the scientific enterprise or the scientific understanding of the universe in terms of story. One way of looking at what we know about the way the universe is. And describing it as story is tremendously useful, I think. Certainly the descriptions that we've had of the way the universe is, the quantitative descriptions and that understanding that has enabled our whole civilization as we know it today is tremendously important. But this recapturing or re-imaging what we are understanding as story, I think, is as equally important toward our future as a species on this living planet Earth. One of the things that I find so compelling about this movement to take what we understand from the scientific enterprise and look at it as story is that it opens up the questions of meaning within. The questions of meaning that are inherent within these understandings, these revelations that we are finding out about the universe. Now, as any good story does, the meaning is woven throughout it, it underlies it, and for the most part, it's
compels that meaning out of you. It's not so much inherent in the story as that the story draws forth your thinking and reflection and rumination on what the meaning of this is. And it seems that that's been so lacking so far in the scientific enterprise. So I want to tell a bit of this story today. The focus of the story today is going to be on our hidden neighbor today, the sun, which is seems to be taking a day off today, or at least from our immediate presence. So this focus will be on the sun. It's this part of the story. But within this, I want to use this part of the story to draw out these three threads within the warp of the universe. So sit back, close your eyes if that's helpful. We'll do a little bit of storytelling here. When the universe flared forth, it was capable of a particular spectrum of activities. When the laws of the fundamental particles were stabilized, the universe's capability for creative action advanced to a new and rich set of possibilities. With the emergence of the primordial atoms and the galaxies, the creative capabilities were again transformed to a new level. The hydrogen and helium and galactic structures altered the large-scale dynamics as well as the small-scale nature of the universe. With the beginning of each new era of the universe, activity and its multiform possibilities undergo a creative transformation. Galaxies after supernovas are qualitatively different from galaxies before supernovas. When the star implodes and the neutrinos blast out vast remnants of the stars are sent streaming away at such high velocities that in a relatively short time, these new elements, carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, are thoroughly mixed into the swirling gases and stars of the galaxies. Stars of second and third and higher generations arise out of a fundamentally different galactic matter. In the Milky Way, 4.5 billion years ago, the disk of stars was relatively rich in all the elements. Rushing through this sea were the two great spokes of the density arm, whose velocity at the edge of the Milky Way was 20 miles per second. As these invisible waves spun, they drew forth millions of starbursts, each new star with its own particular destiny. But now we focus on one branch of this galactic evolution, the one leading to our sun. In the area of space-time where the sun emerged, the density wave passed through every 100 million years. The most massive stars exploded as supernovas and enriched the stellar matter. By the time of the sun's birth, perhaps 100 passes of the star-making wave had occurred. Eventually, a wave swept through that triggered the burst of some 10,000 stars at once. This cluster of stars ranged from blue giants with surface temperatures in the range of 50,000 degrees,
able to burn so brightly, but exploding after only a million years. All the way down to small, cool stars with surface temperatures of only a couple of thousand degrees, but capable of burning for hundreds of billions of years. 10,000 stars, and each had a different fate, determined by the waves fracturing the initial cloud. One of these subclouds was destined to become the sun of our solar system. All its trillion pieces, without any awareness of the amazing journey that had been chosen for them. In the beginning, the solar cloud was distinguished from other subclouds primarily by size. Larger clouds were fated to become blue giants that would quickly move into collapse or a red giant phase. The smaller clouds were headed toward long and relatively cool existences as white and brown dwarf stars. But the solar cloud, our solar cloud, 5 million times the diameter of the sun, this cloud headed toward an adventure near the center of the main sequence of these stars. This formation would be finished in 5,000 years. The subcloud, freed from interactions with the others, gathered itself into a state of increasing non-equilibrium. Matter fell into a center, creating a great deal of heat that radiated out from collisions. After several hundred thousand years, the central core became thick enough to trap its own light and began to heat up even more rapidly. The core was in size the same as Jupiter's orbit around the sun today, but comprised less than 1% of the total mass of the solar cloud. When the core's temperature reached 2,000 degrees, the hydrogen molecules melted down into single atoms, and the core collapsed in upon itself still further, generating more heat. As the matter continued to collapse down and pound on this inner core, the temperature rose until all atoms were ionized back into their elementary particles, which brought about the final collapse. The pressures of the plasma core grew to match the gravitational pressure pulling them together. When the temperatures reached 10 million degrees, the hydrogen at the center began to form helium. Our sun was born. A piece of the story then. Story of the sun, part of very much fundamentally a part of our story, the story of the earth and where we are at now. Within this story, though, the focus today that I want to bring out are these three characteristics or elements that are woven into this piece of the story, but are also woven throughout every event, every element within the story of the universe as we understand it today. These three characteristics are interrelated and woven within each other, but we can sort of separate them out, kind of get a glimmer or a glimpse of them independently. They come out of a great deal of work tracing back into work of Teilhard de Chardin and others, and I think articulated first in some of the work of Thomas Berry, and then sort of drawn out more in this collaboration between Thomas Berry and Brian Swim. So they emphasize these three elements, these three characteristics, these three threads within the warp of the universe. Differentiation, subjectivity, and communion. Some words for each of them, and then I'll try to weave them into the story, give you and I a little better feel for them. Differentiation, some other words that we could use to describe what this means are things like diversity, complexity, maybe separate, identity. A characteristic that we see at all levels and in all events of the universe is the universe tendency or experience of the universe that tends to pull these elements in the universe into differentiation, to be different from one to the other, from one from the other. At the beginning of the universe, the current understanding is that there was no, the differentiation was very low, that the elementary particles were very homogeneous, were very much the same. It was hard to tell one piece of the universe from another. If you picked one piece of the universe and looked at it, and then picked another piece of that universe and looked at it, it was very much the same, very similar. And in the journey of the universe, in the evolution of the universe, this tendency toward differentiation has been made manifest. That when we look at the universe today, if you look at one piece of the universe and another piece, very different, very different. That not only in spatial terms is the universe very different, but in its development, it's very different. How the universe developed has been a sort of a song of diversification or differentiation. The large-scale structures in the universe, from the fireball to the galaxies to the primordial stars or the first-generation stars to the second-generation stars and the planetary systems around those, each of these events was a singular event in time that has not been repeated. The fireball, this amazing burst of energy, of creativity within the universe was a one-time event. It was, and it's never going to be repeated, as far as we can tell. The formation of galaxies, when it happened, was just trillions of galaxies forming. All of them different, one from the other. And yet, there aren't any galaxies forming now. That was a one-time event. That was the event of the galactic formation, that the universe had done that, been there, done that. You know? And now it was on to something else. That differentiation that had occurred there, it was now time to move on to other things that were happening. So this sense of differentiation or diversity, complexity, separate identity, variation, disparity, articulation, all of those senses of the word is both a spatial and a temporal understanding in the way the universe works. Within the star that has become our sun, you can see maybe this differentiation most readily in just that beginning of that formation, when you have this kind of smudge, this floating cloud of gas, the prestellar material that makes up the star. And the density arm that's part and parcel of our spiral galaxy, rotating as our spiral galaxy rotates around its central core, as it moves through this smudge of non-differentiated matter,
it sort of shocked it, it shook it. And with that little bit of push, that little bit of shaking, that cloud of matter began to differentiate itself, began to form its own separate identity from that smudge. And so out of that kind of homogeneous smudge of cloud of matter, we have this incredible formation of a sun and this planetary system, very different one from the other. If you think about the sun and the earth, I mean, what greater differences could you think of? The sun is just its size and in character, in what's happening in both of those places. And yet both of those came out of the same smudge of material, the same non-differentiated cloud, as well as all the other planets. Each planet, one very different from the other. So we have this process of differentiation that's at work in the formation of our sun and our planetary system. The second one, subjectivity. This isn't I think one thing, you think another, we don't know which is true so much as the sense that there's an interiority or an inner dimension of things. Another word that's used to talk about this is still kind of a strange word, autopoiesis. Self-organization. Self-organization. Interiority. All these words used to talk about this idea of subjectivity. Oh, the other one that I liked a lot in this is presence. Presence. This sense that a fundamental thread woven through every event in the universe, through every object in the universe, is this subjectivity. Let's see if I can draw that out in this story of the formation of the sun. As this cloud of interstellar gas begins to compress on itself, sort of shaken up by this density wave, and under the force of gravity being drawn in upon itself to a center, it's a self-organizing dynamic takes place. The galaxy, which is bringing forth this sun, doesn't tell it what to do. It doesn't give it the blueprints. You know, there's no engineer out there saying, okay, if we want to build the sun, this is how we go about it. All right, bring that hydrogen over here, and then you're going to you're going to have to heat it up a lot, and you're going to have to strip off these particles, and the cycle turning hydrogen into helium. Well, this is how it goes. Here's the diagram for that. Nobody is doing that, right? I mean, there's nobody doing that. In a sense, once it's begun, that process has its own self-organizing dynamic. It knows, in a sense, what to do. The fundamental forces acting upon it create this movement, and what happens out of that is in a sense, the presence, the interiority of the sun acting. So this element that's been made diverse, that's been separated out of the smudge of gas, once that process has begun, its self-organizing dynamic takes over. To give you a sense of that, we are at present trying to replicate the process of the sun here on the Earth, with the whole work toward using fusion as a way of generating energy. And it's a very complex task to try to do. I mean, the best that they've been able to do is they pour tons of energy into this thing, and they get out a little bit, right? Okay? Now the sun is just flooding the universe with energy. I mean, on the Earth, all of the energy that the Earth receives from the sun is a billionth of the amount of energy that the sun throws out into space. So our best efforts at trying to do this so far in a contained way here on the Earth haven't been able to achieve this. Okay. But the sun, without any engineers or any blueprints, self-organized itself into this process from which all of our other processes have taken place.
There's some kind of an internal balance that keeps flying apart and blowing itself up.
Yes, very much so. In fact, that internal balance that's going on is maybe a way of moving into this communion idea. That, I mean, why doesn't the sun just fly apart? Just blow itself up, right? All this energy coming out, and yet there's this great sense of communion within that. Some other words for talking about communion: interrelatedness, interdependence, kinship, mutuality. I'll write some of these up here. Interrelatedness, independence, interdependence.
Sounds like we're getting toward human.
That's the idea.
Well, that's the process of the sun and the solar formation, and our solar system formation has eventuated in humanity. So there's certainly that sense in which, again, these are threads woven through every event, every part of the universe. Let me say a little bit about this communion with the idea of the sun, the formation of the sun. The sun's autopoiesis, or its self-organizing dynamic, that's taking place not just when it formed, but right now, as it turns hydrogen into helium in this nuclear fusion process at the center of the sun, depends deeply on the way that the universe came into being. It depends deeply on the fundamental forces at work in the universe. In a sense, the sun is at all times in deep communion with the rest of the universe. The example of that is the strong nuclear force, which we sort of discussed in an earlier session here as one of the four fundamental forces in the universe: gravity, electromagnetism, the strong nuclear force, and the weak nuclear force. The strong nuclear force, which became differentiated in the fireball, this flaring forth of energy at the very early stage in the universe, that within that, the strength of that bonding was a sun. Right? Inherent within that bonding was the nature of what the sun would eventually come to be. The strong nuclear force is the force, it's just the name that we give to why the protons and neutrons in the center of every atom stay together. Right? You may know that protons are positively charged. So if I had a proton here, if that were a proton, and here's a proton, they're both positively charged, so they should want to fly away from each other because of this electromagnetic force pushes them away from each other. But within atoms, when the structure of atoms was first understood or investigated, it was thought that, well, these protons, these elements within would be sort of flying around throughout the atom. Well, they're not. They're all tightly grouped together at the center of this atom. So in the center of the atom, you've got protons just tightly bound together. And what binds them together? Well, we say the strong nuclear force binds them together. That's a fundamental understanding. We don't know really what that is, except the strong nuclear force. It's one of the way that the universe acts. So this way that the universe acts, this strong nuclear force, is deeply embedded within that is deeply embedded this, if you will, a longing for a sun. If the strong nuclear force were diluted just slightly, if it were a little bit less, okay? So if the force with which these protons are bound together were just a little bit less, just a little relaxed, then the proton and neutron deuterium pair would not be able to form. Okay? A proton and a neutron bound together, those would break away from each other. And then the sun, the stable burning of hydrogen within the sun could not occur. It just wouldn't be possible. The sun could not exist if this strong nuclear force would just a little bit relax. Okay? If it were a little bit tighter, if it just held on a little bit tighter, didn't want to let go, a little bit tighter, if that strong nuclear force were that, then the diproton, a proton and a proton would be stable, those two would bond together in a stable form, and all of the stars would just blow up. They would just fly apart out of communion. There would be no communion of the star then. No interrelatedness of the hydrogen within that star to form helium. So in a sense, the star is in deep communion with these fundamental forces and activities in the universe. They are what allow the star to be. Okay.
Brian,
yes.
It seems to me that what's happening here is that there's a perfect balance of forces everywhere in the universe. And it's just perfect, right?
Well, there's a sense in which the universe is the way that we see it because of that balance. I mean, now, some people have said, well, if the balance were different, then the universe would be different than we know. I mean, so it's sort of just saying to say that the universe exists says that there's this balance is perfect. You see what I'm saying?
But aren't you saying, though, that, for instance, if, you know, if the universe, if the Big Bang lasted just a teensy bit longer or a little less, it wouldn't exist at all. Either way, it would be too much either way.
Same well, that the universe as we know it today would not exist. This was in a session earlier, we talked about the expansion of the universe. If that were slightly faster, then there would be no way, formation of atoms would occur, and then those would be at such distances from each other that no galaxies would form, no stars would form. If the expansion of the universe were just slightly slower, the universe would expand for a million years, some atoms would form, and then the gravitational pressures would pull them back together into a collapse. But so there's this knife edge balance that the universe wants.
Yeah, and it does in these forces too, like with the,
mm-hmm. Yes, very much so.
Okay. So the fact that we exist, the fact that there is sophistication at all in the Earth, is just that very, very narrow and perfectly balanced timing, a lot of energy, all the four forces are just exact. And if they weren't just exactly there, there would be no sophistication at all. Nothing ever would have developed that would be sophisticated.
That's currently the understanding.
I think that's a stop.
Why do we think that the Big Bang only has happened once? I mean, do we have evidence that would suggest that that's true? I mean, what if, you know, in the expanse of time, what if we are actually on the straight part of a very long sine wave? Mm-hmm. And so then in the middle of this sine wave, which is billions and billions and billions of years longer than we can possibly understand, everything looks linear. Mm-hmm. But as you get closer to any one of the curves, then things change. And obviously that brings you through a phase where this cycling can happen. I'm not a physicist, so I'm asking this question. Is there some reason to believe that we're not on a sine wave and the Big Bang is just at one of these real compressed points on the sine wave?
Well, there are some models of the large-scale development of the universe that use that understanding. And certainly there's a great tradition in the mythical traditions of the cyclical nature of reality. I mean, it's certainly that grows out of our understanding of the rotation of the Earth and just our experience of that. And there are some mathematical models for the universe that have the universe expanding to a point, the differentiation that we see occurring, and then the universe drawing back together under the force of gravity, collapsing down, and then beginning this process over. The current measurements of what's called the curvature of space-time, which depends on whether the universe just keeps expanding forever or whether it will expand for a while then come back together, is the measurements of that so far have shown that we can't determine, we can't measure precisely enough, at this point anyway, to determine whether which way that's going to go. But just another point that you brought up is sort of one that can be confusing in that, is in thinking about the expanse of time, like there being something before the universe and there'd be something after the universe. Well, the expansion of the universe is not just an expansion of space, but the expansion of space-time. So in the real sense, time began 15 billion years ago, as well as space beginning 15 billion years ago, which is somewhat hard to wrap my mind around anyway. But it's something to speak about before the universe began is, in some ways, to speak about a different time. It's not the time as we know it. I mean, maybe there was something, but time as we know it began in that flaring form.
Can mankind jeopardize that arrangement?
Locally, yes, and we can maybe talk a little bit about that. The idea of these three elements as forming fundamental ordering of the universe has led some people to think about what does this say about ethics and morality? What is good and what is bad? If these three characteristics form all of the interweavings of the universe, then can we say something about what's good and what's bad? And then to that question, if we sort of go against these three, then can we jeopardize the development of the universe? My sense from reading about this is that probably locally we're a biggest danger just to ourselves. That the idea of saving the Earth is somewhat of a misnomer. The Earth will take care of itself in the larger scale development of it. What we may do is we may drown in our own wastes and just end the human development
of the story. So there's a sense in which really the movement into a more ecological perspective is a self-preservation movement. I mean, we really need to look at this as we need to take care of ourselves, and to do that we have to take care of the earth systems that support us. So I would say yes in a small scale way, but in a large scale way, I would tend to say no. Yeah. Other thoughts on that?
Going back to the Big Bang, that the Big Bang occurrence did not occur in a defined moment.
Can you clarify that?
Well, I mean, it was an ongoing thing.
Instantaneous?
It wasn't. He's talking about it as instantaneous, but I think maybe it might have gone on for more than one moment.
Well, there's certainly an element of time in which the evolution of this flaring forth of energy took place and developed. And so there's a beginning of that, if you will, and then there's the development of that.
Yeah. The
sort of maybe like an analogy might be human conception. And there's certainly a moment of conception, and then there's the development of that. That egg to an embryo and a fetus.
We're talking about the universe, but we are now, with the sophisticated telescopes that we have, we're still mapping the stars out there. Somebody is sitting at the telescopes every day, every night, mapping them out, finding ones that. And none of us will.
Finding a great differentiation.
None of us will live long enough to complete the map. This will go on for a million years.
Yes, they're estimating a trillion galaxies within the universe, and billions, hundreds of billions of stars within each galaxy. So it's a lot of stuff out there. And current understanding is it came out of a single point, a single quantum event.
Mm-hmm. First of all, I think this creation story is pretty incredible. It's so mind-boggling that it really, for me, fits a description of God, because this is so huge. Ooh.
Right.
As you were talking about subjectivity, I was thinking about, oh, we have this moment, and things start moving, and then you said there's really no architect or no pattern. And as you got into subjectivity, I thought, ooh, the self-organizing principle seems like a free will to organize as it works best at the moment, even though there are forces that that self-organizing principle has no control over. Mm-hmm. And so I guess my big question is, in this, for you or for scientists or however you want to respond, where's God in this? Because it seems like God's
to
me anyway.
Well, my own, I'll just speak for myself on that. Certainly different people have different interpretations of that. My own sense is much yours, that the more I learn about this story, the more apparent my sense of God within the story is. That the idea of a self-organizing dynamic, to use that one example, does not in any way for me sort of say that God is not there. What it says is that my image of God as the clockmaker, the supreme clockmaker or the architect who designs all of the plans, is re-imaged. I have to rethink that. That sense in which God stands apart from creation and draws up the plans and then sort of ships it, it may not be the best image for it. Maybe the image of the God within the creation, sort of bringing forth creation,
And even in the, from the Genesis story, the whole idea that within the Genesis story, God saying, let there be light, and there was light. Light came forth. God saying, let the earth be fruitful, and the earth was fruitful. You know, that sense in which there's a self-organizing, that, that God doesn't need to be removed from that. In fact, it seems to me that that places God more involved in the whole process.
Yeah. I get a
dilemma here from the objective description of the universe unfolding, as you phrase it, and then the human dimension. Because some of these words have values in the human context that maybe they don't in a scientific context. Right. And so here's the dilemma between one point of view saying it does, there's no need for a God for any of this to occur, it just happens. And then there's another point of view to say that, well, it's so awesome. That it must be the work of God.
I think that's a good way of saying it, and I think that brings up this whole, what I find, again, to be the value of the story perspective, or using story to talk about these understandings, is that it opens these doors for thinking about meaning, for thinking about what does this mean that the universe is this way? And the up to this point, it seems, the scientific enterprise has tried to distance itself from that. For a lot of cultural and historic reasons, that has occurred. You know, some would even say that that's the best way to do science, is to distance yourself from that. But this movement, I think, is attempting to challenge that. And to say that may not be the best way to do science. That might be a very useful strand in science, but it may not be, to think of pure science as, I love this quote from, if any of you have seen Star Trek, and just going back to the very original Star Trek, I mean, the image of the scientist there was what? Spock, okay, this non-human, dispassionate, no emotion at all. And there's this quote in one of the episodes where a woman who has fallen deeply in love with Spock, you know, is trying to bring him out, and he says, "Emotions are alien to me. I'm a scientist." And just that cultural sort of perspective that science is not about emotion, it's not about any sense of value or perception, I think is really needs to be challenged. Yeah. And I think it's not, it can't just be thrown away or sort of disposed of. It really needs to be re-imaged. We really need to take what we know from science and re-image how we think about it.
Well, science takes this thinking further into human nature. What does it?
Well, that's maybe a good segue into this next piece. What I'd like to do is have you sort of make this a little more personal, okay? And so to do that, I said at the beginning of this that these three threads are woven in out throughout every event and every moment of the universe. So let's move this to a personal level, all right? Think of an event in your life, a situation in your life that's important to you. And I would just ask you to share this with someone else. So make it something that you feel comfortable sharing. But just pick the first thing that comes to mind when I say an event or happening that's important to you, that's been important to you in your life. Some specific thing, event that's been important to you. Draw that up in your mind. Bring that up. Okay. And now think about that event in terms of these three elements. Okay. And I'll just give you an example
from my own. When I sort of posed this question to myself, the first event that kind of came to my conscious mind was my birth, right? I was born, okay? That's been an event that's been very important to me. And within that event, these three elements are very much tied within that event. I mean, the idea of differentiation within my birth was this, and the whole process of my development to being born was this whole process of differentiating from my mother and from my father, who had an event with that. But within the womb of my mother was a whole process going on of differentiating. The cells within my body were becoming different than the cells within my mother's body. Subjectivity, interiority, a self-organization, and a presence. If it were up to me now to figure out how to put me together, or even up to my mom, who I have great respect for and admiration for her intelligence and creativity, but if she had to sit down and think about how to do that and write that out, I mean, I wouldn't be here. You know, I wouldn't have been born. There's a sense in which there's a deep self-organization that occurred within that process. And in a deep interiority and presence that I still feel from that. And communion, interrelatedness and interdependence, within that process of being born, certainly that interrelatedness and interdependence with my mother in that process. But then also with the whole mass of humanity as it had occurred. When I was born, for the first 10 seconds or so, I wasn't breathing. And they thought that I wasn't going to make it. And all of the medical, technological support structures for medicine were there to help bring me in to this life. So within that own example, these three elements deeply woven within that. So use that if that helps you to think about this. And I'd just like you to get with one other person, maybe someone who you don't know. Tell them your name and share your story. And the way we'll do this is each sort of tell the event within a couple sentences. And then see if together you can sort of tease out these three threads woven through that story. So take a few minutes here. That was
28. No, I mentioned, I think something that was significant in my life was the death of my mother when I was 5 years old. And I happened to be an only child. And I think a lot of times among my friends, I felt different. Like there was something different about me. And yet gradually, I think that made me kind of reach out and to other people a little bit and find out what their lives were like. And I learned to know that there were other people who had the same experience mm-hmm. as I had, mm-hmm. which was a revelation to me. And another, the sense of communion, I think, was that, because I didn't have my own mother. Sometimes, one member of the family came and stayed with us for a while, and I stayed with another part of the family for a while. Another part of the family, and I have a real strong sense of how important that larger family is mm-hmm. in my life.
Mm-hmm. So the death of that parent, sort of within that, seeing those three threads, yeah, thank you.
I don't know if we talked about this before I came in, because I came in about half a year, but our group was also talking about marriage, but it came up about a couple that had split up, and I thought about this earlier. So you're talking about when I walked in the fundamental ordering of the universe, and I wondered, when we get into the human sphere especially, it seems like there's so much disorder. Mm. Have you mm-hmm. talked about that at all, and how do we put that in perspective with this idea that everything is ordering itself in mm-hmm. the best way, but there are many things that feel so mm-hmm. disordered.
We haven't really talked about that. That's a good the question kind of came up here too about death you know, as a process that takes place, and how is that, how within those processes that are seemingly disordered or coming apart, where is these principles within those? What's that the bell for?
There's something about the, you mentioned earlier, we may drown in our own crap. That may be part of the ultimate disorder of our time.
Well, are some stars collapsing onto themselves?
Mm-hmm. There are processes within stars at the end of their ordered existence, they collapse and destroy. And there's a real sense in which destruction and violence and are a part of this arc within the universe. And that sometimes these are seen, I think, with sort of a perspective of, I don't know, the rose-colored glasses, things that are nice or that we really enjoy happening, are these processes of building up. But within these incredibly violent, destructive processes, I think there are also these threads woven within them. For instance, to take the death of a star, it's within that supernova explosion of a star that enables the differentiation of the different elements, carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, iron, all of the elements that eventually have come to make up our bodies and our Earth, were synthesized within that star and then cast out into the universe in that violent, destructive event of that explosion.
That has a potential for a new form.
Yes, yes. So there's a sense in which somehow fundamentally, and it's nothing I can explain, you know, it's something I wrestle with and struggle with, is how does this violence and destructiveness weave itself within the universe. But I think that these fundamental warp that underlie the universe are within those processes as well. Those destructive events can be seen as the autopoiesis or the self-organizing. That it's a phase of it that seems very disorganized, but it leads to greater levels of organization. And that's in the arc of the wide arc of the development of the universe, that's what seems to appear.
In having done a lot of workshops in therapy in my life, one of the things that has come up as a dynamic is like when we're really close to making a breakthrough, we're probably most confused. And it's like, you know, those three elements you mentioned the other day, the processes. It's like when you're trying to reconcile two ideas and they come real close together, when the fire and the energy get the greatest and the tension builds, and then you make that breakthrough, you get the aha, like that dynamic that happens and everything changes.
Mm-hmm.
It happens the same way as astronomically as it seems to do in a process of personal growth. So the evolution of the universe seems to mirror the evolution of the individual there. And I feel that the disorderliness usually is trying to find going from being an ego to being part of the spiritual life. And the orderliness seems to be there in the, you know, like the confidence and the hopefulness and feeling good about life, being at peace, are when I'm connected to God, when I really feel in a prayerful state. And then I don't seem to do things that create destruction, you know? Mm-hmm. Which I think is the problem we're at right now. Mm-hmm. We're so disconnected from God, we're just on this rampage of materialism and, you know, information, technology, and materialism, mm-hmm. to the point where we're just ignoring it every day. And what we really are headed for, right. We're not paying attention to the goal.
Yeah. I think that's all the time we have to talk about this in this forum, but if you'd like to continue this conversation with each other and with me, I'd be happy to talk more with you and appreciate your being here and take part in this weaving, disordered in parts seemingly, but together in this larger arc, showing great beauty and creativity in that. So be a part of that.